सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्वषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। ॐ वासुदेवेन्द्रयोगीन्द्रं नत्वा ज्ञानप्रदं गुरुं मुमुक्षूनां हितार्थाय तत्त्वबोधोऽभिधीयते। Repeat after me. Tattva-viveka-ha kaha, tattva-viveka-ha kaha, atma-satyam, atma-satyam, tadanyat-sarvam, tadanyat-sarvam, mithyeti, mithyeti. So I have a confession. Several years ago, I was in the Himalayas and I was doing ghora tapas, terrible tapas, sitting in a cave for an entire year in just a loincloth. And I gained the siddhi, the special power. And most siddhis are pretty spectacular. You can shrink down to a minuscule size, or you can grow as large as a mountain. Or you can co-locate. You can be in two places at the same time. Or you can fly. Well, my siddhi was that I could hear pieces of jewelry talking. It's a very small siddhi. It was all my tapas was worth. So I came down from my Himalayan heights and I went to a cafe, ordered some chai, and was sitting there. And this woman came by and sat down in the table next to me. And I heard her bangle, and it was saying, "Oh, woe is me. This woman takes no care of me. I have such a difficult life. She's always banging me on the table. She never puts me in a safe place. She never takes me off. I'm always banging against the sink. I'm always banging against the counter. She works out in the field. She's always getting me dirty and dusty and scratched. And I used to be twice as thick as I am now. I'm soft 22 karat gold. I'm always out in the sun. Dirty. It's a horrible life as a bangle here." And her necklace that was on the woman's neck turned as a necklace can turn to the bangle and said, "You think you have it bad? You're out there in the sun all the time. You're enjoying all the special treatment. You're in full view all the time. This woman puts me on and then hides me. She never shows me. I'm always covered up. I never get to see the sun. I never get to see the daylight. Sometimes she will take me off and leave me in a drawer for months at a time. Oh, the plight of a necklace, this poor, poor necklace incarnation I have. I have no job satisfaction. Maybe next life I can be born as a bangle like you." And the bangle says, "Oh, maybe next life I can be born as a necklace like you." And unfortunately, my tapas wasn't great enough. Wasn't ghora. Ghora tapas. Wasn't severe enough. I couldn't talk to them. They couldn't hear anything I had to say. And I thought, what a tragedy. What a tragedy. You know, there is no shame. There is no problem being a bangle that's tossed around by the vicissitudes of life, needing to do the work that you need to do. And there's no problem being a necklace, which is hidden from view, which no one sees the glories of. If the bangle and the necklace recognize that they are both gold, the bangle and the necklace have no problem if they see their role, their ornamented role, as just a role, their particular name, their particular form, as being a role that they're blessed with in this life. If they see that they are in truth gold and not limited by the particular name and form which they seem to enjoy at the moment. The dharma of a bangle is to be the best bangle it can, to make the loudest jingle it can. And the dharma of a necklace is to hang gracefully and adorn whoever wears it. But the moment that that bangle's ahankara rests in its ornament tvam, the suffix tvam creates an abstract neuter noun out of almost any word. So the ornament tvam, the state of being an ornament, then it's a disaster. It's devastating. It's a tragedy. If the bangle goes through its entire life not recognizing the truth of itself as being no different than the entire gold universe. And so to the necklace. And just think of the drama. Understand the drama that we all participate in when we identify with this ornamentation we go through life with as a man, as a employee, as a relative, whatever role we play as a father, as a brother, as a boss, as an employee, as a student, as a teacher, the roles that we inform can be joyful roles if we understand that the particularities of that role are not satyam, are not truth, are not in truth who I am. It's like an actor. An actor can play a role of a beggar and be doing all the motions, going through all the motions, can even be crying, wailing at its bad luck. And then that same actor can turn around and play a king. And he realizes that he is not poverty stricken like the beggar, and he is not infinitely wealthy like the Raja, like the king. Because we inhabit those roles. Those are incidental to us. The ornaments are incidental to the gold. In truth, if I had stayed in that Himalayan cave a little longer, I'm sure I could have gained the siddhi to talk to that poor bangle, have compassion on that poor bangle and say, Tattvamasi, you are gold. She might say, how can I be gold? I'm just a poor little bangle. I've always been a bangle. I will always be a bangle. I will never be a necklace. I will always suffer the problems of bangletvam, of being a bangle. I will never be free. I will always be bound until the day I die. What's the problem with that? The problem is that the bangle is missing a very self-evident point. The self-evident fact is that that bangle is now and always has been and always will be just gold, shiny, valuable, without a care in the world. Everybody's delightful object, gold. Atma satyam tadanyat sarvam mithya. The self is satyam and everything else is mithya. If the eye lands on any little piece of this anything else, tadanyat sarvam, we're doomed, to put it dramatically, because it's not true. We're misidentifying ourselves. There's so many assertions we make about ourselves to ourselves constantly, that I am a little bangle, I am a little necklace, I am a little toe ring, I am a crown. So many assertions we make that we need a method to rectify that. And this next sentence starts that process. It starts to negate all of these notions we have about ourselves in a very detailed way. It takes this notion of ornamentation, if you will, and looks at each little part What does it mean to be a bangle? What does it mean to be a necklace? It doesn't use that analogy. But in fact, what this author will say is, who is really the truth of that individual being, of that necklace? Is it this curly Q over here? Is it the clasp? What is it? He says that Atma is Satyam, that I am the true thing. I am the Vastu. I am the thing that exists. And everything else has a dependent reality. Everything else is Mithya. The ornament is Mithya. The bangle is Mithya. It is Sat Asadbhyam Anirvachaniyam. It cannot categorically be stated to be existent, truth, Asti. And it can't categorically be said to be Asat, Tucham, completely non-existent, like a square circle or the Vandhyaputra, the son of someone who's never had a child, is in between. And it is adhishtana ananyat. Something that is mithya is adhishtana ananyat, is not other, ananyat, than its very basis, its very substance. So the ornament is never separate from the gold. And yet the ornamentation comes and goes. And you can't say it's real, and you can't say it's not real. You can't say it's real because the gold existed, it did not exist. It exists, the gold exists. The bangle does not exist, the gold will still exist. So what's the truth of this gold? What's the truth of this gold that's dressed up like an ornament right now? So he asks the question, so please repeat after me. Atma kaha, atma kaha, stula sukshma, karna sharirat, vyatiriktaha, panchakoshatitaha, panchakoshatitaha, sanna, avastatraya, avastatraya, sakshi, sakshi, satchidananda, satchidananda, swarupaha, swarupaha, sanna, sanna, yastishthati, yastishthati, saatma, Sa'atma. It's quite a mouthful. He asked a question. Atma kaha. So what is this atma? Because he just previously asked the question, what is this tattva vivekaha? To which the answer was, this tattva vivekaha is that the atma is satyam and everything other than the atma is mithya. Okay, well, what is this atma that you say is satyam? And he gives an introductory sentence he will expand upon during the next several paragraphs. So we'll just look at this sort of a high level right now, and then all the detail you could ever want about all this, he will be introducing in a very detailed level. And he introduces three prakriyas here, which negate the anatma, which attempt to show what is not atma, for the sake of revealing what is Atma. So he makes three negating statements and the one affirmative statement in the sentence, and he will go and elaborate on this much further subsequently. So we'll just touch on these. Stula sukshma karna sharirat vyatiriktaha. The whole sentence is, Yaha tishtati, that which stands. Tishtati means standing, it stands. Yaha is a relative pronoun. Yaha tishtati, saha atma, at the very end. Often when you translate Sanskrit, you start at the end of the sentence. When you read it, you can read it from the beginning, but the punchline doesn't really come to the end. The punchline is usually the verb, and also often you have relative and correlative phrases. So yaha, saha, that's a relative and correlative pronoun. The one who does this is this. The one who walks quickly, he is the one who reaches the destination. The one who is tall, he reaches the top shelf. So Yaha, the one who tishtati, who remains, Saha, that is the Atma. And so what is the one who stands, who exists as what? He stands, he exists, this Atma exists as Yati Riktaha. Then you jump to back to the beginning of the sentence, because Yati Riktaha, Atitaha, San, Sakshi, Swarupaha, these all stand in apposition, these all modify this Yaha, the one who is this, the one who is this is the Atma. So at the beginning of the sentence, it says, Stula, Sukshma, Karana, Sharirat, Vyatiriktaha. The one who is Vyatiriktaha, the one who is distinct, the one who is separate. Separate from what? Separate from the Stula, Sukshma, Karana, Sharirat. In Sanskrit, when you say something is different than something, that than is in the fifth case. And the fifth case, the ablative, is sharirat. Sharira means a body. Sharirat means from or than the body. Yati riktaha, the one who is distinct from the body. And what is this body that he's talking about? He's talking about a threefold body. So this threefold body, the first is stula, often translated as gross, but really it means tangible. This tangible body that we're all familiar with, this thing that was born, we keep feeding, and which will eventually go back to the earth, this physical body. This Atma is separate from, is distinct from. And we see that in our experience. We see that this body is an object of our knowledge. I know this body. I know the body. I, as the knower, am different from what I know. I objectify the body. The body is an object of my cognition. I am not what I perceive. I am not the objects which come within the scope of my senses. I am not this body. Now, I remember, I'm not saying this body, what this body is. I'm just saying that the Atma, I, am the perceiver. I am not this body. This body, in fact, as we've seen, is nothing but me. Well, need some more unfoldment here, but remember, A is B, but B is not A. This Vyatiriktaha, being separate, is the second part of that sentence. B is not A. B is not A. Atma is not the body, but A is B. The body is Atma, because the body has no independent existence of its own. The body is mithya. The body is an assemblage. The body is time-bound. The body is neither real nor unreal. Sadasadbhyama nirvachaniyam. The body is adhishtana ananyat. It's not different than its substratum. Where's the body? All I see is hands and fingers and arms and legs, etc., etc. We talked about this last week. So I am not this body. This Atma is vyatirikta from the stula sharira. Also, there's a sukshma sharira. And he'll go into all these details of what this is, but basically, the sukshma means subtle. Stula can mean gross, tangible. Sukshma is that which enlivens this physical body. So it's the mind, it's the senses, it's the prana. It is that which leaves when we die. When we die, the body loses this sukshma sharira. So you can look at the sukshma sharira as the transmigrating soul. Soul, it might not be the best word for that because it has so many connotations, but it is the jiva which inhabits the body. And the enlivening systems, the mind, the senses, the pranas. The reason we say sukshma, subtle, is because it's not visually perceptible. You don't perceive the sukshma sharira through the senses. But we do perceive the sukshma sharira. We know the pranas, we know hunger, we know thirst, we know thoughts, we know emotions, we know ignorance, we know knowledge, we know the senses, we know our capacity to act. That's all included in the sukshma sharira. So it's not unknown. It is known to us as an object, and we're different from that. Sukshma stula karana sharira vyatiriktaha. There's a karana sharira, and we'll talk more about this in detail, but it is what's referred to as the karana sharira, the causal body, not the casual body. It's not the casual body, it's the causal body. It is responsible for an experience of deep sleep. It's this individual in a potential state. It's an unmanifest you, unmanifest jiva, like a seed, right? The seed said to be the karana. Karana means a cause. So it's a causal body, meaning that when we go to sleep and we're not dreaming, we, in a sense, retract into this causal body. And it'll make more sense once we discuss it later on. Vyatiriktaha. So we are separate from that. This is one model, this three-body model. There's another model, which is the panchakosha, which is presented in Upanishads as well. Here he says, panchakosha atitaha. Pancha means five. Kosha literally means a sheath. Atitaha means that which is separate, that which is different. And this panchakosha is often misunderstood because the terminology that is used is a sheath, as if a scabbard, you put a knife into a sheath, a sword into a sheath, which then covers the knife. It covers the sword. But the problem with that is that these panchakoshas, these five koshas, do not cover the self. It's not like you are a little tiny being and you have these five spheres around you. They're more properly understood to be five levels of experience that provide opportunities for us to make reasonable mistakes about ourselves. And they're reasonable because everybody makes them. Everybody has these five points of misidentification based on the upadhis, based on this karya karana sandhata. And these five koshas, let's just use the word kosha because sheath is just not a good word at all. So these include our bodies. These include our prana, anna, prana. When I say I am fat, I am skinny, I am tall, I am dark, anna maya kosha. When I say I am hungry, I am thirsty, prana maya kosha. I am agitated, I am emotional, I am decisive, I am clear thinking, I am reasonable, I am a doer, I am an enjoyer. Those are two big ones. I am a doer and I am an enjoyer. Those are all examples of where we place the I. It's where the ornament says, I am nothing but a little bangle. I am the body. I am the mind. I am the intellect. I am this ahankara. I am my memories. I am my personal history. I am my emotions. My emotions feel so strong. When I get angry, I'm angry. No, you're panchakosha atitaha. You are not that phenomenon that occurs within your individuality. There's no reason for you to identify the I as that, but there is this ahankara, and if it's based in ignorance, then there is a complete identification with that, with all these thoughts and feelings and emotions, you know, our loves, our anger, our jealousies, our sense of inadequacy, our wishes to be different. I wish that I was the necklace. I wish that I was the bangle. So the panchakosha atitaha sanna, being atitaha, being different than the five koshas, than these five opportunities for mistake, we'll see in more detail. And then he says, avastatraya sakshi. Avastatraya sakshi. Avastha means a state. Traya means a triad, a threefold state. The three states is best translated as. I am the sakshi of three states. What does that mean? Nevada, California, and Oregon? I'm sorry. I meant to say Karnataka, Andhra Pradesh, and Tamil Nadu. The three states, of course, are the waking state, the dreaming state, and the sleeping state. I am the Sakshi. I am the witness of all three of those states. In the waking state, I identify as the waker. In the dream state, I identify as the dreamer. In the deep sleep state, I'm identified with this, with just the karana sharira, with just this ignorance that comes over me. I'm just in a deep sleep and I don't know anything. There is no ahankara, individual thought, in deep sleep. But still, I am a sakshi for each of those. I am the one who is ever awake. Does the atma sleep? So in one sense, if someone asks you, don't you ever sleep? You could say no. Because sakshi means sakshat ikshate iti sakshin, the one who is always awareful, self-evident, sakshat ikshate. Iksh means to see. One who is the drik, the seer, which never drops away. I am the one who knows the coming, the presence, and the going of all thoughts, of all experiences, of all mental states, whether they be emotions, thoughts, perceptions, memories, or even these states of consciousness, if you will. We like to reserve the word consciousness for something different than the states of quote-unquote consciousness. It's really their states of mind. Does consciousness awake? Does consciousness go to sleep? Does consciousness dream? Does consciousness think? Consciousness, I feel, is best reserved. The word is best reserved for awareness, which is the sakshi of the thinking, of the dreaming. If you use that word loosely, it's easy to get confused. Several decades ago, there were consciousness erasing groups where you raised your consciousness about social issues. That's fine. I mean, that was a good thing. People needed to be aware and gain sensitivity about certain social issues. But consciousness raising, it's not like you raise your consciousness. You raise your awareness. Even that is problematic, right? Language. You become sensitive to certain issues to which you should respond in potentially more dharmic ways. That's a function of the mind. Waking is a function of the mind. Sleeping is a function of the mind. Aham, the Sakshi, is the one who is present and illumines all states of mind. The individual phenomenon, which is within the waking state, or whatever happens in the dream state. And we'll talk a lot more about the dream state. The dream state can be seen as the Achilles heel of avidya, because if you look at dream very carefully, a lot can be revealed about the realities that we live in. But right now, we're just looking at dream as a phenomenon of the mind. So I am this awareful being, this existent awareful being, which illumines, as we saw in meditation, all passing thought. I don't come into existence when a thought comes, and I don't leave existence when a particular thought goes. I am not catching the train of thoughts. I am standing on the station watching the train of thoughts go by. You know, this example that I gave in meditation of a lamp illuminating a dancer on a stage is one that's in one of the other Prakarana Granthas, Panchadashi. It's in the book by Vidyaranya, Panchadashi. And he says consciousness is luminous, and that luminosity falls on the dancing woman, it falls on the stage, it falls on the audience alike. It doesn't care where it shines, it just shines. And the dancer can dance the most beautiful dance, and the dancer could fall, unfortunately, on her face. Hopefully it's not her Arangetra, it's, you know, she's practicing. She can be in step, she can be out of step. The light doesn't care. The light is asanga. The light just shines. Bhati, it shines. Asti, it exists. The light exists and it shines. And it is asanga. It is unaffected by whatever happens on stage. And what's this stage that it's illumining? This consciousness illumines what stage? Does it just illumine the world that I perceive through my senses? Oh, it does that. But this body, this body is known to me. This body is another object in this world. It illumines this body. And whether this body is healthy or big or small, consciousness, awareness just illumines. There's no value judgment. All mental phenomenon. If I want to make assertions about myself that I am the stula sharira, the sukshma sharira, the karana sharira, the annamaya kosha, the pranamaya kosha, manomaya kosha, the jnanamaya kosha, anandamaya kosha, any of these panchakoshas, it will let me. This light doesn't care. This dancer can do whatever it wants. It can dance a beautiful sattvika Bharatanatyam dance. It can dance about Krishna eating dirt and giving the vision of the entire cosmos in his mouth. Or it can be any other kind of dance. It can be talented or it can be amateurish, it can be professional. This light illumines anything and everything. It's a sangha. Sangha means attached. It's sticky. Consciousness, Atma, is not sticky. In fact, Pooja Swamiji would say that it's like Teflon. I think I was taking my course when Ronald Reagan was president, and he was known as the Teflon president because nothing stuck to him. He could do anything wrong and no one blamed him for anything. A Teflon president. And consciousness is utterly non-sticky, as is existence. Curious that. It's curious. Everything flows by consciousness and it is never stained. There's no contrail. No phenomenon leaves a contrail in the sky of my awareness. It's always fresh. It's always fresh. It's ever fresh. That's one translation of the word Purana. Purana means ancient, right? But another translation of Purana, as it pertains to the Atma, is it's ever fresh. It's ever in the moment. It's never sticky. Nothing sticks to it. Asangaha, that's what it means. And it's self-revealing. So it's self-shining. It's self-revealing. How do we know our consciousness? How do we know that we are awareful? Do we need a separate awareness to come through and illumine my awareness? If we needed another awareness to recognize my awareness, then which awareness would I be? I am aware of the mind, the body, the feelings, the thoughts, the memories, but I don't need proof of my consciousness. Everything is evident to me. The body is evident to me. My perception of an object is evident to me. My actual perception is the evidence that I need that it exists. I can only say that something exists when I see it, when I perceive it, when I know it through a means of knowledge. But the self doesn't need a means of knowledge to be evident. The self does not need a means of knowledge to be evident. Well, wait, Daksha, what do you mean? This Vedanta is a means of knowledge. Don't you need a means of knowledge to know the self? The Atma is never hidden. The Atma is self-luminous. The Atma is swatasiddha, self-established. The Atma doesn't need, I do not need a proof that I exist. I do not need a proof that I am conscious. Now, the nature of that conscious being that I am, to understand that, I need a pramana, I need Vedanta, I need a means of knowledge which will say, neti neti, not that, not that. Maybe you are sukshma stula karna sharirat yatiriktaha. Maybe you are panchakosha atitaha. Maybe you are avastatraya sakshi, and then it'll turn to you directly. That what's left is a self-established, self-shining, awareful being. And then it will say, Shastra will say, Tattvamasi, Satchidanandaha, Asi, you are that truth. That is Satyam, not Mithya. And we'll see this shortly. So the Atma consciousness, this light is self-shining, self-luminous. It does not need another light to light it up. It's like the sun. How do you know that the sun shines? Because you see it. It's self-evident. Do you need a flashlight? You need to go out. Even though there was a solar eclipse today, a partial solar eclipse today, you didn't need a torch and shine it at the sun to go see the sun because it is self-luminous. Now, bhati. Bhat means to shine. Bhati means it shines. So we can say about ourselves, aham bhami, I shine. I'm self-luminous. Now, what about the moon? Does the moon shine? Oh, don't get confused with moonshine. That's something different in America. You know moonshine? Moonshine was illegal alcohol. Maybe they make that in India, toddy. I don't know. They use corn mash. They take corn and the sugars from the corn. They mix with the yeast and they'd make alcohol and they'd be out in the, you know, the cliche is that these people live in the hills and make their own corn whiskey. I imagine they do that with coconuts somewhere in South India too. But moon, they call it moonshine. And I guess because they snuck out at night and they worked on their stills and processed their alcohol. But that's not the moonshine I'm talking about. I'm talking about the moonshine that we see at the full moon. Can we say the moon bhati? We know that the sun bhati, the sun shines in and of itself. Does the moon shine in and of itself? No. The moon's luminosity is borrowed. The moon anubhati. Chandraha anubhati. Suryaha bhati. The sun, suryaha bhati. The sun shines of its own accord because that's its very nature. Chandraha anubhati. Anu means in keeping with, a secondary, following. So the moon shines after the sun. The moon is opaque. It has a reflected luminosity. And that's the luminosity of the mind. The luminosity that the mind seems to enjoy, the awareness which this mind seems to enjoy, is a borrowed awareness, a borrowed consciousness, just as the luminosity of the moon is borrowed from the sun. Aham bhami, I shine. Manaha anubhati. Mama manaha anubhati. My, mama. Manaha, mine, anubhati, shines after me. Everything shines after me. Everything that I perceive shines after me. So we see that he's making the statement that Atma is distinct from the stula, sukshma, and karana sharira, from the pancha koshas, and from the avastatrayam, I am the sakshi. Consciousness in the presence of an object becomes a witness to that object. But what is the very nature of that Atma, of that Sakshi, of that self-luminous existent being? That's a huge topic. We don't have a lot of time to go into it. But what's left after all of this negation? What's our inherent nature? The Atma is not the body, the Atma is not the mind, the Atma is not the emotions, the Atma is nothing that exists in this physical or subtle world. Why do we bother with that? Why do we do that? It's because we always assert to ourselves that this is what we is, what we are. This is what we be. We are that. Look at your everyday experience. Look at your mind. We're convinced. I am this body, I am this mind, I am these emotions, I am angry, I am good, I am bad, I am jealous, I am tired, I am sad, I am scared, I am happy, I am blissful, I am hungry, I am thirsty, I am blind, I am deaf, I am, I am, I am, I am, I am, I am, right? Look at that. I am that, I am that, I am that, I am that, I am that. Look what you're doing. Look what your mind is telling you. Look, I am X, I am Y, I am Z. The world is filling in the blanks for us. The world is filling us in. I am the necklace. I am the bangle. I am the toe ring. The Kano Upanishad says, Pratibodha viditam matam, Brahma. Pratibodha viditam matam. Bodham prati viditam jnatum bhavati. The nature of aham, of atma, is recognizable, pratibodha, in every cognition. It's just mind-blowing. It's just mind-blowing that it's saying that in every cognition, the truth of the Atma exists and is recognizable. The pot does not cover clay. The ornament, the bangle, does not cover gold. Thoughts do not cover satyam. Thoughts are mithya. Mithya does not cover satyam. In every cognition, what is there? Look at what we talked about just a second ago. I am angry, I am sad, I am happy, I am large, I am small, I am male, I am female, I am talented, I am untalented, I am. There is the consciousness, the awareness of all these objects and all these qualities, which I then superimpose on myself because I take myself to be these. And we're very closely associated with them. But our essential nature is this I am. Because he says, Sat Chit Ananda Swarupaha San. Being the Sat Chit Ananda Swarupaha. Swarupaha means Swasya Rupaha, the form of oneself, the very truth of oneself, the very nature, the true nature of oneself is Sat Chit Ananda. And we've all have heard this term, and there's a lot to go into here. A couple things I want to say about it. One is, when we use language, I mentioned this before, we always use adjectives to modify nouns. It's a visheshana. Adjective in Sanskrit is called a visheshana. And we use adjectives to differentiate them from other objects of the same group. We have a nila sugandhi utpala. Utpala means a water lily. Nila means blue. We have a blue lily. We have a sugandhi utpala. We have a fragrant. Gandha means a fragrance. Sugandha means a good fragrance. Luckily, this is a good, a nicely fragranced lily. Sugandhi means that which has sugandha. Sugandhin, sugandhi. Utpala, a lily. So it's blue lily and it's a fragrant lily. And the reason we say it's a blue fragrant lily is because there are non-blue lilies and there are unfragrant or poor, badly fragranced, stinky lilies perhaps. It's to distinguish that from other lilies. Now, I don't need to say a blue fragrant lily to distinguish it from an elephant. The adjective blue and lily do me no good in distinguishing a lily from an elephant. But to distinguish the blue fragrant lily from the white fragrant free lily, I use those terms, nila sugandhi utpala. Now, we have this phrase, Satchit Ananda Swarupaha Atma. Satchit Ananda Swarupaha Sanna Yaha Tishtati Saha Atma. That which remains, that which abides. Tishtati is best translated as that which abides. Yaha Tishtati Saha. That is the Atma. Being which is Sun. Satchit Ananda Swarupaha. Whose Swarupa, the Huvrihi Samasa, compound, whose swarupa is Satchidananda. So does the term Satchidananda, do these three words, which stand in apposition to Atma, just like apposition, not opposition, it's an A, grammatically, apposition means that they modify, grammatically, they modify the word Atma, Yaha. Satchidananda swarupa, whose nature is Satchidananda. Do these three terms uniquely qualify Atma to distinguish one Atma from another? Like the fragrant blue lily. We use the fragrant blue lily to distinguish one lily from another. Are there many Atmas some of which are Satchit Ananda and some of which are not. No, there's not. So what are these so-called adjectives here? Why are we using them? There's not many Atmas. He's not going to say, yes, this Atma is Sat, is existent, and Chit, consciousness, because that Atma over there is Asat, is not Sat, is not existent. And that Atma over there is inert, is insentient. But this Atma here is sentient and existent and limitless. No, it doesn't work that way. Why doesn't it work that way? This is all Shankara. Shankaracharya talks about this example of the Nila Sugandhi Utpalam. When there is an object of which there is only one instance, Visheshanas become Lakshanas. Visheshanas assume the form of Lakshanas. A Visheshana is an adjective which is used to differentiate one from another, like we've said. A lakshana is a revealing word. It reveals the nature of the very thing. It's not an adjective, it's definitive. It's not descriptive, it's definitive. It's defining the very thing that it's talking about. It's standing in grammatical apposition to. So Satchit-Ananda is not a phrase that is adjectively describing the characteristics of Atma. It is saying that Atma is Sat, Atma is Chit, and Atma is Ananda. Often we see the terms Satyam, Jnanam, Anantam, which are synonyms, if you will. And we'll go into that in detail later. And so how can you say that they're not adjectives? Well, look at space. This is an example Shankaracharya gives. He says, it's like space. Avakasha pradatra akasham. Akasham is avakasha pradatra, that which accommodates. Avakasha means accommodate. Pradatra is that which gives. Da, give, pradata. But here it's neuter, pradatra. It gives, akasham, it gives accommodation, literally. Avakasha, pradatra, akasham. Space is that which gives accommodation. It accommodates everything. Without space, you couldn't have three-dimensionality. So why do you say space is avakasha, pradatra? Is that to differentiate one space from another? Because this space is accommodating, this space is constraining. No. You can use the term avakasha pradatra to reveal the very nature of space. It's not used to differentiate. It's not an attribute. It's the very nature of space. It's like wet water. It is used to actually reveal the targeted meaning. Lakshana means a lakshate anena, by which it is revealed. It provides the meaning. So, Satchit Ananda. I think we're out of time, unfortunately. But this will be the big cliffhanger for next week, or for the next class, I should say. This will be the cliffhanger for next class. He's pulled the rug out, and he will go through all this in much greater detail, but he's pulled the rug out from everything which we hang our Ahankara hats on. He's pulled the rug out from the body, the mind, the senses, the pranas, any experience that we have, 24/7, waking, dreaming, sleeping. And then he says, Satchit Ananda Swarupaha. We've seen a little bit of this. We've seen a bit of what Sat is. Atma Satyam, when we talked about Atma Satyam. We've talked a bit about what Chit is, Chaitanya, consciousness. But the Sat and Chit are not two separate things. It's not that the Atma has a quality of being existent, like an existent table or an existent chair. The word existent seems to be an adjective describing a table and a chair, because there can be non-existent tables and chairs. It is not an existent self. It is existence itself. It is not a conscious self. It is consciousness itself. When I say itself, I mean yourself. He's saying here that you are not existent. You are existence. You are that satyam upon which all this mithya depends. You are that consciousness. You're not just a conscious being. You are consciousness. You are existent consciousness. Or you are conscious existence, which is ananda. Ananda, we have to look at very carefully, but it's in this context, it's best to look at it as ananta, satyam jnanam ananta, as limitless. So we have limited existence. We know limited existence. Something has an existence now, but it didn't have existence in the past. It won't have existence in the future. We see that with objects. They seem to pass in and out of existence. I am ever present. Aham asmi. I can never say I am not. It's always right now, and always right now I am. And I am conscious. And in fact, when I identify with the mind, which anupati, the mind, the manas, shines after my consciousness, which I am. When I say I am conscious, does it point to the mind or does it point to consciousness itself, which is not different than existence? And if it points to the limited reflection of consciousness in the mind, that is not ananta, satchit ananta, ananda, limitless. The reflection of consciousness in the mind is not limitless. It has limits. Every thought seems to limit consciousness because every thought comes and goes and has a certain name and form. But if you look at limitlessness in the context of sat and chit, what does that mean? What is limitless existence? What is limitless awareness? And that limitlessness is not a separate thing from the consciousness and existence which you are, Atma. The very swarupa, the very nature, the truth of the Atma is Satchit Ananda, is that existence, that consciousness, which is limitless. Where does the I land? The I is a rascal, the Sahankara. Let's look at this. This is your homework for the week. Look at where this eye lands. It lands all over the place. Like mercury, it's quicksilver. It'll land anywhere and everywhere. And it is so convincing. I am this thought. I am this feeling. I am this characteristic. I am that. I am that. I am that. And the interesting thing is that in every cognition, there is I am. I am. I am. We have it is. It is, the table is, the body is, the thought is. There's the table consciousness. The thought of the table, when you look at it, is table consciousness, which exists. Table consciousness is, book consciousness is, because I know it. I know the book. There's book knowledge. There's in a different sense, there's table knowledge. There's computer knowledge. There's knowledge of the floor, there's knowledge of the roof, there's knowledge of the wall. This knowledge is really, we can use the word consciousness. There's table consciousness is, chair consciousness is, body consciousness is, consciousness is, consciousness is. That awareness and that consciousness is not separate from anything that we know. In every cognition, even the I thought, I am, is really straddling the fence because it's outward looking. And by outward, I mean every looking at the whole stula, sukshma, karana, sharira, the whole panchakoshas. That's outward looking. All those are anatma. All those are outward looking. And the ahankara keeps hooking us. I am this, I am this, I am this, I am this. But this I am is aham asmi. I exist. And aham bhami. I shine. Everything shines after me. Everything exists after me. We can point to everything and say, look, everything exists, everything is, but you look at any one thing and you cannot find its true existence. It does not truly enjoy existence. No object in this world truly enjoys existence. I exist. I exist and I shine. Everything shines after me. Everything has borrowed existence. Atma satyam tad anyat sarvam mithya. Atma is real. Everything else has a dependent reality. That is that satchit ananda, which you are. The author will go into a great amount of detail talking about the stula, sukshma, karan, sharira, ityadi, etc. And it's very interesting because these models are very comprehensive and they help us really encapsulate our limited notions about ourselves. And once we can recognize the limited notions we have about ourselves, we can free ourselves from those limited ideas. And every time we delve into this nature of the truth of myself as Satchitananda, Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma, every time we delve into that, it will become clearer and clearer. The more we notice, the more we are cognizant, the more we are alert to this tendency that we have to completely identify with this stula, sukshma, karana, sharira, with these panchakoshas, with this avastatraya that he's saying that we're not, we're the witness of, we're free of. It's like we're a red-hot iron ball. Remember that? A red-hot iron ball. And I think that iron is hot and red, and I think that fire is heavy and round. The luminosity and heat of the red-hot iron ball is just borrowed. The heaviness and the roundness is just borrowed. It does not exist in fire. The heat doesn't exist in the iron ball. This is this anyonya dhyasaha. This is this mutual superimposition we need to tease apart. We need to be able to see the iron ball for what it is and the fire for what it is and see that clearly in our vision, in our knowledge. We don't need to let the ball cool down to see that, right? We don't need to transfer the heat to something else. We need to see that the consciousness and existence and the I-ness, I-am-ness that we attribute to this physical body, to the subtle body, to the karana sharira, the causal body, that is not a true perception. That's not true knowledge. That's an anyonya dhyasa, a mutual superimposition. So it helps us to go into a great bit of detail about what is the nature of the stula sharira, what is the nature of the sukshma sharira, what is the nature of each of the panchakoshas, what is the nature of the waking and dreaming and deep sleep state. So we can clearly see all of our potential spheres of misidentification. And once we clearly see all of those opportunities that present themselves at every moment, which invite us to identify with, once we see that clearly, and once we see our true relationship with them, and the fact that there are these little traps that are not true, these little identification points that like I said, the iron has always been hot and red, and the fire has always been round and heavy. It's not that case. Once we see all this in enough detail through these comprehensive models of the three bodies, the five koshas, the three states of consciousness, then that satchit ananda will become clearer and clearer and clearer and clearer until tattvamasi, that knowledge becomes obvious. So we'll see that, we'll begin to investigate that in the next class. Okay. Let's sit for a moment. ॐ स्वस्ति प्रजाभ्यः परिपालयन्तां न्यायेन मार्गेण महिषाः गोब्राह्मणेभ्यः शुभमस्तु नित्यं लोकाः समस्ता सुखिनो भवन्तु काले वर्षति पर्जन्यः पृथिवी सस्यशालिनी देशो यक्षोभरहितः ब्राह्मणाः सन्तु निर्भयाः ॐ सर्वे भवन्तु सुखिनः सर्वे सन्तु निरामयाः सर्वे भद्राणि पश्यन्तु मा कश्चित् दुःखभाग् भवेत् असतो मा सद्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मा अमृतङ्गमय ॐ पूर्णमदः पूर्णमिदं पूर्णात् पूर्णमुदच्यते पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेवावशिष्यते ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हरिः ॐ श्रीगुरुभ्यो नमः हरिः ॐ तत्सत् सर्वमीश्वरार्पणमस्तु.
Actually, so question I had is like, the more and more we get conscious about the I Am presence and start to kind of like appreciate how we are the source of happiness. I'm just wondering, a couple of issues there, not issues like, not to sound like a negative or anything, but aren't we becoming more selfish? Like we are starting to ignore about others, their life. I mean, it's their happiness and they have to do it. Or in general, do you get more like an introvert where your world, the world becomes just around you, right? So is that kind of a side, unnecessary side, what is the thing called? Like when we take medicine, there's a side.
A side effect?
Side effects, yes, that's the one. So is that, I mean, obviously that is not a good thing. I mean, is that something that's typical? Comes through this process?
Well, I would want to ask, who is the selfish person? The selfish person is the one who tries to manipulate his or her experience or world or relationships to get what he or she wants to make him or her happy, to use too many pronouns, right? So when you're selfish, you try to gather and keep valuable things. And the value is defined by their potential, their ability to make you happy. So that can be people, that can be money, that can be experiences. You try to get all that, and you try to retain it. That's, to me, what a selfish person is. And often overstepping the bounds of compassion, or overstepping the bounds of propriety, objectifying someone else for your own ends, for your own purpose, thinking about your own happiness over someone else's. And I think that last one is your point, right? You're thinking about your own happiness at the expense of someone else's happiness. But if you see yourself as, if you know yourself as purna, as complete, as the source of happiness, if you see yourself as a source of all happiness, then you have no claim on anything. You need have no claim on anything, because there's nothing here that's going to satisfy you, because you are already satisfied, right? Right. When you've finished a big meal, you're not selfish with your food because you're no longer hungry. You can give all your food away because you're full. Everybody can have as much food as they want. I'm not going after that. In fact, when I'm full, I'll gladly give all my food to other people. I can choose to go out and occupy myself with selfless work. There's nothing at stake. My happiness is not at stake. My completeness is not at stake. So I can be, I believe, more compassionate and more giving than someone who feels small because they need to grab these little things to make them feel full.
Yeah.
Now, for a jnani, for one who knows, one can choose to just sit and do nothing. It's a lot of it's prarabdha, what the world calls you to do and what your own inclinations as informed by your life experience calls you to do. You know, Ramana Maharshi just sat and people came to him and he taught and he meditated. And he didn't go out and feed people and, you know, serve people. Other people might go and start hospitals and start service organizations. Puja Swamiji, you know, he started off in a little hut in Rishikesh on the Ganga. That's actually now his ashram in Rishikesh. And now he has this, he's started a couple decades ago, a service organization, Aim for Seva, which is doing all sorts of good work around India to help educate and provide food and shelter for disenfranchised children who are not getting the education they need. So he's collecting donation and creating these chatralayas, these housing for students. So I think you have the potential to be more selfless when you don't need to manipulate the world about you to complete your sense of worth and happiness. Does that answer your question? Or there?
I mean, I would say like it's a get a full understanding of yourself first, and then you are happy with it. Then you can spread it around, or like you can kind of like do things at your will.
Yeah. And it's when you say do this first, you can do them in parallel. Seva is a beautiful sadhana. Seva is karma yoga. It's a form of karma yoga. If you have the bandwidth and you have the situation, you can always give a little and you can always help people in whatever way you can. You can devote your whole life to it or you can do a little bit, but just seva without the pursuit of knowledge, you will end up doing good in the world. But you may not complete your life's purpose without looking into the nature of who you are.
Can I ask a question, Dakshaji?
Yes.
One of the things that I have noticed about myself, when your interest in knowing yourself becomes very strong, what happens, I mean, this is my experience, is the world sees you as being indifferent. The world sees you as being, uninterested. The world sees you as being not responsible enough. You seem to lose out. I mean, in that sense, you seem to become a sort of recluse, if you like. But then, of course, very often when I observe that this feeling is there amongst the people around, I try and correct that, but then I can also feel, yes, that probably I have roles in the world which I have to fulfill. I have duties in the world which I have to do.
Yes.
And therefore, I must, whenever these things come up, I must tell myself that, yes, this is something that I should be doing. And I'll do it as sincerely, as joyfully as possible. But sometimes, this doesn't really happen. So I was worried. I was not worried. I mean, I was really seeing how do we match or how do we, it's like the wheels of a car. If one of the wheels is going away to the right and the other is going to the left, obviously there's going to be confusion and disaster.
Yeah.
How do we combine these two goals, if you like, with the need or the feel, the urge for a spiritual, increased spiritual awareness of yourself and so on? So this is really my question. I hope I've not made a very long, drawn-out question.
No. You make a lot of sense. And it's a good question. In my experience, I can just talk from my experience. And what I observe of like Swamiji and then my own inclination is that you're right. There can be seen to be two paths. One is pravritti marga and one is nivritti marga. Pravritti marga is a path of engagement and nivritti marga is a path of disengagement. And so in the Gita, it's talked about as sannyasa and karma yoga. Mm-hmm. Pravritti marga is you're fully engaged in doing all your responsibilities. And nivritti marga is a life of sannyasa, doing nothing but this. And many of us straddle the line. because maybe our hearts are in this and we tend not to have much of an interest in other things. This is the passion we have. And yet we have other responsibilities that are prarabdha, our destiny, our duties call us to fulfill. And it's just on, I think, on an individual level, you can continue with this, with your spiritual pursuits, make time for your daily meditation, for your puja, for your study, and still be responsible in your world to the degree that you feel you need to be responsible for things. Many of us can't get out of that. That's why they have sannyasa. If you're, I think if you're lucky enough to take sannyasa, that's why you would, because all these other interests fall away. It's like all these optional engagements fall away naturally. But some of them are not optional. Unless you, you know, are lucky enough to be in a position to be able to take sannyasa. And again, maybe this is just my own view. Then we have these other obligations that we need to do. And we need to do them wholeheartedly. We need to do them with love and attention, even if our interest is not there. Because as a karma yogi, when we're in that situation, we're karma yogis. And our option there is to do that. Our obligation there is to do that with Ishwara Arpana Buddhi and Ishwara Prasada Buddhi. Ishwara Arpana Buddhi is that we're offering this to the Lord. This person who needs this help, I need to cook this meal for this person. That person is Bhagawan. At the very least, you're getting punya, which won't hurt you in the end. It can only help you in your spiritual work. And that ability to put your own desires aside is a noble thing to do. And you can still be awareful of your spiritual practice in the midst of doing uninteresting things. You know, you can do japa. You can do, like I talked about, seeing this I thought come. You can be seeing this no matter what you're doing. And to the degree you feel you are a karta, you're sort of missing the boat. I am the doer. I am the doer. I'm not the doer. I'm the experiencer. I'm not the experiencer. So you can bring that contemplativeness into whatever activity you have. It's a matter of where you want to put your time and attention and the world calling you to be looking at something else. And that's prarabdha. One thing I've learned is that I can make choices much more freely than I thought I could. At one time, I thought I didn't have choices in my life and that I needed to live a certain lifestyle. And then I realized that was just a self-imposed rules, and that to a certain degree, I was much more free to make choices about what I did with my time and attention and my limited lifespan. Life is so precious. I can be choosing to do this when the opportunity comes, and then do what my kartavyam. We have obligations in the world, and yet our heart is in this non-worldly pursuit. And once you have some vairagya, once you have some viveka, you have some vairagya, and you lose interest in a lot of these things that make you an interesting social person. On the other hand, the most social person I know is Pooja Swamiji. What I mean by social is that he has met a million more people than I will ever meet in my life. He has had conversations with tens of thousands of people. He's constantly in the presence of people. He's constantly teaching and having satsang and having interviews and talking. And so he is not disengaged at all. He's fully engaged. It's that what he's engaged in is spiritual activities, shravanam, mananam, nididhyasana, and helping people, talking to people. He does such extraordinary help. He lifts so many hearts just by a simple 10-minute conversation with people. And he does what he can. He has this charitable organization, and he gives his time freely to people who ask. So he's very engaged, even though he's disengaged. We have this notion that sannyasa is a very solitary lifestyle. And he has said that he would not be the person he is today if it were not for satsang. And he created his own satsang, but he deliberately went out and sought the company of like-minded sadhakas so that he could focus on what he found interesting, and which was this sadhana. Some thoughts.
Thank you, Acharya. I think it's very useful to remember that, yes, there is no difference between your role and your being, the truth of what you are. And I think if your role is to do something, you have to do it with as much love and care and affection and attention that you can command at that particular moment of time. I think we should remind ourselves about this. I'm very grateful to you for your answer.
Yes, that's very well said. Ishvara, we haven't talked about this at all, but you have a deep background in this. Ishvara is karmapaladatta. The Lord Bhagawan is the giver of the fruits of your actions, which manifest as your prarabdha, which manifest as your given life. So when you serve somebody, when you give to somebody, you're serving Bhagawan. You're directly, you're serving Ishvara, not only because that person is no different than Bhagawan, but the fact that they are in your life is your karmapala, which is given by Ishvara. So there's nothing separate from Ishvara in at any level that you look at it. So it's all puja. It's all worship.
Dakshaji, I had a question, and talking about the inverse logic or the negation that you alluded to. Mm-hmm. How would you kind of, on those lines, how would you kind of like tell a person that you are not having sadness as an attribute, right? Like, so we're talking about happiness here, that we are full of happiness and we are just getting covered up by Maya, or like we are not just having the time to realize it. We are already full and the truth is already there. Mm. So like, does it mean that happiness, if there's happiness, there should be sadness, right? So two sides of a coin. Mm. So it's kind of a tough argument, I know, like, but how would you tell a skeptic of your talk that you also have sadness, or you, I don't know how you'll convince that, okay, you only have happiness and you don't have sadness in yourself.
We haven't talked much about this yet, but a dukkha vritti and a sukha vritti, a vritti means a thought, dukkha means a painful thought, sukha means a pleasant thought, are not that much different from each other. And what I mean by that is dukkha vrittis are a tension, a constraint in the mind, a tensing of the mind that occur in the manas, in the mind itself. A sukha vritti, a happy thought, is just as transitory as a painful thought. So I am free as a conscious being of painful thoughts and happy thoughts, sukha vrittis and dukkha vrittis. It's just that a happy thought, a pleasant thought, a perception of beauty more fully expresses the truth of myself. In other words, when I have a happy thought, my mind gets out of the way. My self-concept gets out of the way. I forget that I'm a limited being. I forget that I'm sad. I forget all these problems that I have. And I just get lost in the beauty of a sunset. My mind calms down. And my nature of myself is more accurately reflected in my mind. But that state of mind comes and goes like any other state of mind. The idea that we will be in a constant state of bliss is a misnomer, because anything that's a state changes state. You have a state transition diagram between your happy state and your unhappy state. And it's, by definition, a state changes, like the avastatraya. I'm the witness of all those three states of waking, dream, and deep sleep. And within each of those, I'm the witness of all those states of mind, whether it be a happy thought or an unhappy thought. And we need to talk about this ananda and this ananta more to make it really clear. But this ananda, this swarupa ananda, this ananda which I am, is not synonymous with the sukha vritti, with a pleasurable or even a happy thought. Because I, as a limitless being, am not less so when I have a dukkha vritti. It's just that if I identify with a painful thought, a sad thought, then I have more vichara to do, more inquiry, more listening to do. But if I identify with a happy thought, that happy thought is just as transitory as a sad thought. It's just that that happy thought more accurately reflects the truth of me, whereas the painful thought more accurately reflects my ignorance. That's a bad way to put it. But and it's not always that case either. Sometimes, you know, if someone that I love dies, I'm going to have a painful thought. And I think that's just a given in the creation. We're human beings and we have emotions. And when someone we love dies, I get sad. And that doesn't jeopardize the fullness of myself, because my fullness is based in my knowledge of myself. It's not based on a feeling. Feelings are fickle. Feelings come and feelings go. But I, through my knowledge, am free. Just like when I see the sunset, I don't need to freak out because the sun is going to go every time. I know what's happening. I know the sun comes. I know the sun goes. And if I see that with that vision, then I'm free to let the sun come and go. I'm free to have sad thoughts. If I'm raised in a situation, in a painful situation, let's say I had a very problematic childhood, I'm going to have a lot of some scars. I'm going to have a lot of scars. I'm going to have a lot of emotional things to deal with. And we may never free ourselves from that, depending on what the situation is. But I can change my relationship with those unhappy thoughts and make them bodhita, see through them and say, oh, no, that's not really me. Okay, come on, unhappy thought. You come, you do your work. I don't believe you. You can stay as long as you want. And then just let it go.
You can flip the switch and somehow shut the bad things from going through your head. And
the thing is, you don't necessarily need to do that. So you don't need to stop the thoughts, because you as a conscious being are never hidden. It's just that if you believe these thoughts that tell you that you are a sad person, then your knowledge has not come into play. If you have a sad thought and you're able to go, oh, look at that. Oh, my mind is telling me that I am sad right now. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. You can still have that full feeling, but you don't believe it. You don't believe that the sun is going to really fall into the ocean. And I don't have the ability to make the sun stop from falling into the ocean. I don't necessarily have the ability to stop the mind from having sadness. But the more you stay with yourself and the more perspective you have on things, the less likely your mind is going to indulge in these bad thoughts or be reactive and have that sadness, because you don't see your happiness as being anything, situation, or person being imbued with the ability to make you sad or happy. But still, you need to recognize that we are incarnate beings with, you know, a full set of emotions and a fully functioning mind. And you know, sadness doesn't ask our permission to come and visit. And if we try to push it away and say, no, 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 you're bad, I don't want you here, we're giving it more reality. If we say, come on, okay, there's another sad thought I don't need to have anymore. Maybe I have 100 sad thoughts I need to have, and there's another one that I've just let go of. You can think of it that way, welcoming it. Then you become free. You become a sangha. You become that Teflon. You become that slippery surface through which these emotions just come and go. If I try to push it away, then I'm stuck. You know, it's sticky and I identify with it and I don't want to be that way, and it's bad and I'm bad and I don't want to be that way.
That's true. That's a good way to put it. It's just treat any bad thoughts as a phase of life, right? Or a bad thing as just a phase in your life that happens and it'll just go away. So like, yeah.
Yeah. And then where do you put your attention? Do you dwell on it? The one characteristic of the mind is that it's like having a sore tooth. You just cannot keep your tongue away from a sore tooth. Our mind is like that. We cannot keep our mind away from sad or irritating feelings. If someone comes up and says, you know, if you had just invested in Apple when it was 17, you could be a multimillionaire by now, and you could spend the rest of the week going, oh my goodness, if I had just invested in Apple when it was 17. Or you could just shrug and go, oh well, that wasn't my fate. It really takes some will to keep the mind from going there. And just some of it's just a matter of training. That's what japa's for. Say, okay, I don't need to think about this anymore. Om Namah Shivaya.